You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, economics and business writer for The Week, Jeff Spross, on the job guarantee. Also on the program, Republicans realizing Nancy Pelosi rolled them on the budget, and they can't seem to do anything about it. Meanwhile, Republicans also desperately trying to pass anything on replace and repeal before they go on vacation on Friday. These guys take more vacation than I do.
I hate Nancy Pelosi so much. I hate her. She is the devil bitch antichrist. I hate her.
Democrats and the left winning at small ball. Signs of a potential tsunami. Then surprise, Trump was pissed that someone had released pictures comparing his inauguration crowd to President Obama's.
We will find you.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is sort of tough to talk about, but a new book reveals that Ivanka Trump had to give up massages during the campaign.
Sacrifice. Yeah. Actually, why?
Well, we'll get to that later. Come on, I'm trying to get through this, and it's choking me up a little bit.
Sorry.
Meanwhile, it appears Gorka may not be gone. And an update on that story that David Dayan had for us, I guess a week or two ago, on the pharmacy benefit managers. And lastly, a Dallas cop fired. Charges we don't know yet after killing a teen in a car, being rowdy and leaving a party. Unbelievable. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I just want to do this. There's a story I teased yesterday and didn't get to it. But it is apropos of what we are, what we're discussing today. Because as much as we are seeing, you know, small signs of electoral success by Democrats in small races around the country, in Lincoln, Nebraska, I think last night or two nights ago, they flipped the city council. Does that indicate that they'll win the Omaha mayoral seat, which would maybe indicate or help that they would win that one of those three Nebraskan congressional districts? Those are all questions. I'm not going to actually ask them in formal questions. I'm just going to have a rising intonation. Who knows? We also are 3 weeks away from the race in Montana, where Rob Quist is running, and the DCCC has just dumped $400,000 into that race. There was a primary winner in the South Carolina seat to replace Mick Mulvaney, who is the very odd, in my opinion, Office of Budget Management Director, the budget director for the administration, I should say, former Tea Party guy, or I should say Freedom Caucus guy. That guy who won that primary, a former Goldman Sachser, but also very, very is leveraging that experience, saying he knows where all the bodies are buried when it comes to overseas taxes. He apparently was a tax lawyer there. I don't know how much of his change of heart, but, you know, this is South Carolina in Mick Mulvaney's seat. So there are sort of buds, if you will, little sprouts, as we sometimes see in the springtime. But as you know, there was, it turns out, to be more or less an autopsy performed on the losses sustained by Democrats in the last election, not just the presidential level, but there were losses across the board. And one finding from the polling has been highlighted. Now, much of this stuff hasn't been made public yet. But according to the Washington Post, I think this is Waldman, a shockingly large percentage of Obama to Trump voters said that Democrats' economic policies will favor the wealthy. Wow. Twice the percentage that said the same about Trump.
Unbelievable.
And that's what the polling said. Apparently, Waldman watched some of the focus group activity. And this is Priorities USA. This is Super PAC that I guess is dedicated to restoring Democrats to power. They conducted these focus groups of Obama to Trump voters in Wisconsin and Michigan. Those, of course, the two big states where Clinton lost by, I think it's 10 and 14,000 votes respectively. And also, you know, you had a place where Russ Feingold lost in Wisconsin. This was in late January. They polled 800 of these Obama to Trump voters. They also did, they polled 800 drop-off voters, people who voted for Obama in 2012 but didn't vote in 2016. And these are some of the quotes they heard. Clinton and the Democrats' economic message did not break up. Oh, this is from Priorities USA conclusion. Did not break through to Trump drop-off or Obama Trump voters, even though drop-off voters are decidedly anti-Trump. So they're, you know, even those people who are anti-Trump didn't come out and vote against him. of Obama to Trump voters said their incomes are falling behind the cost of living. Another 31% said their incomes are merely keeping pace with the cost of living. A sizable chunk of Obama to Trump voters, 30%, said their vote for Trump was more of a vote against Clinton than a vote for Trump. These are Obama voters 4 years earlier. 42% of Obama to Trump voters said congressional Democrats' economic policies will favor the wealthy. 42%. 21% of them said the same thing about Trump. Only 40% say that about congressional Republicans. For whatever reason, these people were not getting a moderately accurate picture, right? I mean, it may be true that Democratic economic policies will favor the wealthy, but it is definitively more true of the Republicans. A total of 77% of Obama-Trump voters said Trump policies will favor some mix of all other classes, middle class, poor, all equally, while a total of 58% said that about congressional Democrats. With the drop-off voters, similar dynamic. Priorities USA polling found that 43% of them said their income is falling behind the cost of living. 49% said their incomes were merely keeping pace. Skepticism about the Democratic Party was echoed rather forcefully in the focus group that he had watched. Obama to Trump voters were asked what Democrats stand for today and gave answers such as these. The 1%, the status quo, They're in it for the party themselves and the party. The Democrats, for whatever reason, ranging from perhaps some of their policies, undoubtedly not holding a certain sector of the 1%ers accountable, the bankers. But also, I think we're so late in the game in actually providing any real policy agenda that also could resonate with people. So not to say that on a marginal basis there wasn't some proposals. Well, that's brings us to Jeff Sprouse with his proposal, and this has been going around for a long time, of a job guarantee, otherwise known as the employer of last resort. If you're a Democrat out there and you're looking for a proposal, I mean, we have expansion of Social Security that takes care of you and your pension. We have proposals out there to expand Medicare, introduced in the House, and I think soon to be, if not already in the Senate, by Bernie Sanders. Here's one to deal with jobs. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jeff Sprouse. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jeff Sprouse. He is the economics and business writer for The Week, and his latest, You're Hired, in the journal, where was the piece in, Jeff?
It's in a quarterly magazine called Democracy Journal, which right. is like yeah, it comes out four times a year, and it's kind of this magazine that just tries to pitch big ideas for, like, how to reform American society.
Well, thank you for joining us, and I just I prefaced your appearance with the at least what we know, or the little that we know from some of the, I guess, autopsy from the last election, where Priorities USA had polled 800 Obama to Trump voters and 800 drop-off voters. Those were Obama voters in 2012 who didn't bother to show up. And there wasn't necessarily unanimity, but there was a strong contingent that felt that Democrats were working for the 1%, were not providing them with any major proposals to deal with stagnating wages. And you make the point at the beginning of your piece that we don't hear that much of an emphasis about jobs from Democrats, at least relative to what we heard from Trump during the last election.
Yeah, I think one thing you notice in certainly in the Clinton campaign platform, and even in the Sanders platform, though to a less extent, is that while they certainly talk about jobs as a good thing, it's often seen as sort of like the second order thing that happens because we did something else good, like invested in clean energy or expanded some kind of social welfare program so people had more money to spend in the economy. Trump was kind of unique in that he was really just like, I'm going to get you jobs, like straight up. That's what I'm going to do. Just went right at the issue.
Right. Almost like he almost did the opposite. It seems like every one of his policies was a function of because it would help jobs.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I can go on. I'm a left wing guy. I can go on all day about how terrible I think his stance on immigration is, for instance. But like the fact, the narrative that immigration, like other people coming to the country, makes it harder for people here to get jobs, which like I can also go on about like the economic problems with that. But that's clearly a narrative to some extent about jobs. He's saying like, we need to do this. We need the border wall to protect Americans economically here. I mean, he also characterizes this in terms of crime and sort of thing, but economics is also clearly part of the picture.
Yes, indeed. And and just, you know, trade more generally, I guess. But all right, let's just why would we need something like the job guarantee or employer of last resort, as you call it?
Okay. Actually, to start off, should I explain to your audience what it is? Or
please, yeah, do.
Are they already up?
Yeah,
to
do.
Okay, so I think the easiest way to explain the job guarantee is like during the Obamacare debate, there was the idea of the public option for health insurance, right? It was a package of insurance that would be provided by the government. You didn't have to take it, but it was always there for you if you wanted. And the job guarantee is basically a public option for employment. If you want a job, you don't have to get a job with the job guarantee program. But if you do want it, it's there for you, and they will find something useful to do for you to do in your community, and they will pay you a living wage and give you like health benefits and quite possibly some kind of retirement benefits like in exchange.
Well, first off, have we had anything like this in the past? Because the WPA, the Work Progress Administration, which I guess was basically from, I don't know, mid-30s until maybe just after the war in 40 or before the war ended, for about 5 or 6 years during the mid-30s. Where does that rate? Is that the closest we've had to something like that in this country?
That's probably the closest we've had. We've had several other projects like through the 70s and 80s where we provided this kind of public employment opportunity for young people, that sort of thing. But the Works Progress Administration and several other programs during the New Deal were probably the most ambitious and the longest lasting. They didn't employ everybody, but they employed everybody who needed a job. But they employed a lot of them. And for the time they existed, I mean, you can see like a really clear and dramatic effect on unemployment numbers they clearly like really aided in the recovery from the Great Depression.
So, I mean, let's go into the specifics of how this would work. What kind of job, where would the jobs come from?
So there are several economists who have sort of like been working on this idea for a while. One of them is Pavlina Cherneva, who works at the Levy Institute, among other places. But one of the things she points out is that if you look at like civic organizations around the country, we're talking like, you know, people who do community beautification, people who work on cleaning up public parks, ecological reclamation, refurbishing old buildings, all this sort of stuff. Like, these needs are usually present in just about every community. And for the most part, they're helped out by volunteer work and they're perpetually understaffed. And so the idea is that, like, if you had a government agency that had, like, you know, there'd be a federal part that, like, provides, like, some overall guidelines and the funding, but then you'd have, like, community branches that would go out and talk to the community and say, like, what projects are you guys trying to do that you clearly feel would be helpful and valuable for your community that you just can't find the people to do? And the case Cherneva in particular makes that, like, there's there's just an enormous amount of that. And a lot of times people worry, like, we just can't employ everybody in the economy. And to a large extent, that's kind of a failure of imagination. It's like, let's try this and see how much useful stuff we could actually find.
Well, I mean, give me a sense of like what that would look like in different communities. I mean, those jobs. So, I guess it's like it's a little bit easier for me to have a concept of it in New York, right? I mean, just because there seems to be such a staffing need, and you in many respects have so much infrastructure that already exists, one can imagine what those would be. Although I would love to hear some examples of jobs there. But what if you're in a small town or, you know, a city of 50,000 people, let's say?
Well, I mean, I think you could, in a small town, you could imagine, first off, like, road fixtures, like repairing. I mean, even there's local infrastructure. There might be water pipe issues, electrical access, internet access, particularly in rural communities, is a big thing. So expanding all of those could be things you could hire people for. Again, soil conservation is a big issue in agricultural communities. I could imagine just like repairing fences, for all the different ranches around, like out just outside the town, that kind of thing.
Okay. And then, and in a bigger city?
In a bigger city, I mean, I'd say like you could have like recycling, city beautification, building refurbishment, again, like all the physical infrastructure stuff. And then there's a human care aspect to this as well, in terms of like, you know, do people in the community need childcare? There was a project in Argentina that lasted 6 to 10 years back in 2000 to deal with a big recession in that country. And it was kind of like, it wasn't a full blown job guarantee, but it was sort of like a stingy version. And one thing that like a lot of people, and these were a lot of like rural communities that were impoverished. I mean, like, some people would start like a local shop selling baked goods or sewing clothes, but then like some of the people hired for the shop would be providing childcare for all the other people who were working at the shop, and they too were like employed through the job guarantee.
So, I mean, wait, could you explain that about the bake shop? The people weren't part of the job guarantee, were opening the bake shop. The city was just providing resources to support it through the job guarantee.
Well, actually, my understanding from the Argentina work was that the bake shops were actually sometimes open. Like the proposal that I'm offering, and that what also happened in Argentina, didn't just provide the wages. It also provided a certain amount of like upfront capital if like you were trying to start something like that. So they would open bake shops or like sewing shops or toy making. I mean, there was this whole list of stuff. And the initial wages provided by the job guarantee helped them get off the ground. But then they also made a profit, like selling this stuff to the local community, that they were able to then plow back into expanding.
Interesting. Okay. So give us a sense of like what the wages would be, what kind of benefits one would have.
Okay, so in terms of wages, what I recommended in the article was $25,000 a year. And the reason I picked that was, frankly, because it's like it's what you get from $12 an hour. And that seemed to be the minimum wage that the Democrats in particular like seemed to be the center of gravity. I wrote this in December. The Democrats seem to be like agreeing that $15 an hour would actually be better now, which I'm all for. And that would work out to a $31,000 a year wage paid by the job guarantee. I just say like the idea of the job guarantee is not to compete with the private market for workers. So they wouldn't be like hiking their salary more to pull workers away from the private markets. But what it does is like it's basically a de facto minimum wage. Like, if a private employer wanted to pay less than what the job guarantee was paying, then a worker could always be like, well, I'm just going to go take a job with the job guarantee program instead because they'll pay me more. So it like it is effectively an enforcement mechanism for a minimum wage. And this also applies to things like health benefits. What I recommended in the article was that you could just I got this from William Darity, who's a Duke economist, who's worked on the job guarantee a lot. But his idea is just give the workers access to the same health benefits program that all other federal workers already enjoy. And so you get the same like enforcement there. Like any private employer who like wanted to like attract people away from job guarantee jobs would need to offer benefits at that level or better.
And so in that respect, it acts, that's almost its most, distinct characteristic that is most analogous to the public option, where it is really just adds a competitor, in this case, a competitor, you know, I guess, to vying for your labor business, as it were, and drives up the wages. And it presumably, right, it would drive up the wages of everyone across the board.
Exactly. Yeah. No, this is really a proposal to make private employment better by, as you said, forcing them to compete with a public option.
And, has there been much work on like what the implications would be? I mean, how far up through, employment would people feel the impact? I mean, you know, with like how much upward pressure would it put on wages, you know, through the system?
That is a good question. And I can't give you like really detailed specifics, but I can say that like equivalent studies have been done on like the effect of upping the minimum wage law to $12 or $15 an hour. And like the ripple effects extends relatively high up the ladder. I can't say how high for sure, but they definitely happen.
Now, I know that there must be some libertarians out there who are just expressing dismay that you would in some way put some businesses out of business, right? I mean, because theoretically, I'm no longer going to... I mean, it's the same problem, I guess, with the minimum wage. But you're putting... elevator operators out of business, or some other businesses, I guess, theoretically.
Yes. I mean, I don't think there is any denying that, like, if we instituted the job guarantee, like, a lot of low-paid work would go away. Like, for instance, the fast food industry probably wouldn't disappear, but it would probably shrink a lot, and, you know, the burgers it sells would become more expensive. I'm, like, people who are concerned with, like, you know, eating greens versus eating more meat and all that kind of thing. I mean, you could debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that would definitely happen. And I think the thing to point out is that with the minimum wage, there is at least in theory the possibility that by mandating through law that you have to pay at least this wage, you just simply make it impossible for the economy to provide enough work for everybody. I mean, I want to emphasize that, like, that's highly contested and the data is not clear on that at all. But
right.
That is,
I think, the only
certainly the concern you get from the libertarian camp.
To be
so
fair,
the thing that I guess the
to,
point of
to be fair on oh, that, the ahead. Data, I think, is the only thing that shows is that I think with some teenagers sectors that there may be some job loss. But the job loss, the net is a gain because you're putting more income into people's hands.
Right. Exactly. I bring it up to say, like, that is the narrative you will get from the right, that that's what's wrong with the minimum wage. And I think the main thing to say about the job guarantee is that the basic idea of the job guarantee is that it offers work for everybody. So, like, the idea of eliminating employment opportunities is sort of dealt with by definition.
Right, exactly. And what would happen, what would be the age in which you could, would you start at 18? Would we create some type of underclass of teenage workers who are the only ones who, you know, you could hire for less than $15 or something, or interested in work for less than $15?
I think that's a very good question. And I have to admit that even with a 4,000 word article, I wasn't able to deal with all the particulars. I think, like, what you'd want to do is, like, I mean, you definitely want to be careful about, like, you don't want, like, child labor kind of thing happening. So, like, maybe, like, an age 18 is where the full thing, the full job guarantee comes into effect. But there are definitely, the economists working on this have definitely been sort of spitballing ideas about, like, how, like, you could have an apprenticeship program component that, like, starts out for young people that eventually, like, can move them into the full-blown job guarantee if they want to, and that sort of thing. I mean, the other thing is, like, you know, you don't want to be we need to just be investing in education a whole lot more so that, like, poor communities have good education opportunities. So you're not, like, pulling people away from the chance to learn more so that they pull young people away from the chance to learn more so they can work. So I think there's, like, there's a lot of details to be worked out, but people are definitely thinking about that.
Right. I mean, that's a little bit nitpicky, but I imagine if we get to that point where that's the argument, the proposal's doing rather well. How does it work? I mean, so this functions as sort of like an economic stabilizer, right? I mean, it sort of has a similar dynamic to food stamps, and we should talk about what the implications are for something like food stamps to institute something like this. But food stamps, the threshold doesn't change in terms of your eligibility. But when we go through hard economic times, the number of people who are eligible increases. This has the same dynamic, right? It wouldn't be a program that you say, we're going to earmark X number of billions of dollars annually. It would be a program where we're going to provide for the demand for these for these jobs, as opposed to a base it on a specific number.
Exactly. Yeah, you basically say how many people want a job through the job guarantee program, and then commit to spending whatever amount is needed to meet that demand. And yes, this would definitely be an economic stabilizer. I think it's very fair to argue that if once you have a job guarantee up and running, there's every reason to assume that recessions would be, I mean, they'd still probably happen, but they'd be less violent, they would be less deep, they would recover faster. And the reason for that being is that right now, when we have a recession, people get thrown out of work, and every person that gets thrown out of work is that much less consumption going on in the economy, which throws that many more people out of work. So it's like it's a self-reinforcing negative spiral that keeps going until the economy hits bottom and then begins to recover. And the idea of the job guarantee is that when the private market discards workers, instead of them becoming jobless, they just go onto the job guarantee work. They still have an income floor. They still can spend in the economy and so in the private market and provide consumption for private market employers. So the private market economy should recover much faster.
I should say it's an automatic stabilizer, and automatic you also throw in the idea. I should say mention too in terms of the jobs is one of my favorite ideas of postal service banking. But let's get to how much it costs, because you know, one of the things that I think we've talked about on this show is that if we ultimately and hopefully move to a single payer healthcare system, it's going to involve a significant hike in taxes that people should be aware of. Of course, there's benefits that come with that. You're not paying for your healthcare premiums, but what is the cost that you estimate for something like this? And then, you know, where do we see the universal returns on something like this?
Right. So, I need to pull up my article. I believe my estimation of how much it would cost was around $670 billion.
It was exactly $670 billion, your estimate.
Well, my memory serves me well. And the first thing to note is that is what the cost would be if we started it right now. And the first thing to note is that precisely because you are suddenly pumping more income into the economy, the private markets would recover, wages in the private market would go up, people would leave the job guarantee to go into the private market. So the cost of this program would immediately start falling. And it's difficult to say how far it would fall, but it would, I mean, like if you look at the history of the Works Progress Administration or the history of this program that was instituted in Argentina, I think it's fair to estimate that the cost of the program over the long term would stabilize at least around half of that initial $670 billion, maybe lower. And like $335 billion is less than a lot of the major entitlement programs we have now, their annual.
$335 is close to basically a third of the cost of Social Security. I think Social Security is somewhere around $900 billion annually, and in this instance, not only would it, the actual, I guess, recipients or participants drop, right? Because theoretically, you would get that much more economic activity with the more money, but you're also going to be saving money theoretically on the other automatic stabilizers that we have for people like food stamps, right? Because we'd be driving wages up, and you wouldn't have the concept of the working poor, really.
Exactly. Like, I mean, the number of people who would be in need of food stamps, qualifying for food stamps, would go way down. All of the people on the job guarantee would have health benefits. They would not need to be on Medicaid. So all of the spending on these other programs that like food stamps, Medicaid, and the other programs that provide a similar safety net would fall naturally. I mean, we wouldn't even have to pass any laws cutting them. They would just, like, the number of people on them would just drop. And it's difficult to say how much that fall in spending would offset the spending on the job guarantee. I talked to several economists about this, got a lot of different answers. But, like, the lowest estimate seems to be, like, a fourth. And there were much more ambitious estimates as well. So.
And what happens to the people? I mean, presumably, right, the people who do not opt into this program. I can imagine maybe there are single parents who are living in poverty and they don't have the ability to provide for childcare for their kids, maybe $15 an hour in that their specific region. And I should also add, you do introduce the idea that in certain regions and localities, you may raise the minimum wage based on the cost of living there. But for people who don't, or for people who are disabled, perhaps in some fashion can't work because of an illness or something, is there any concern about, like, increased stigmatization on some level? I mean, talk about the cultural implications of this, because you do raise this idea that, you know, there is a perception that people who don't, who are on public assistance in some way are shirkers. I would imagine on some level that might increase for folks who are not on it, but it might work the other way for people who do look to make use of this as a public benefit.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And I do try to like think through a few cultural implications a little bit in the piece. The first thing I think I want to say is just like, there are a lot of people in the economy. There's a large portion of the people who are below the poverty line who like cannot participate in the labor market, even if they wanted to, but they're too old or they are disabled or, you know, that they're in school. We'd like them to get an education. That's just a basic human need that we should be providing. So like, excuse me. We need a more generous social safety net to like plug these holes that the labor market simply cannot fulfill. Now, in terms of like whether we would stigmatize those people more under a job guarantee scenario, I certainly think you could imagine like a circumstance where you could have a job if you want to. The government's providing it to you. Why don't you take it? And these people are, you know, culturally shamed. I do wonder, however, like how much stigmatization of people on the safety net is a function of the fact that the labor market, even for people who are working in it, is often really unpleasant and low paid and unjust. And there is a sense of like the pie, because of that, there is a sense the pie is not big enough, that we all need to be fighting over our slice lest it go down. And anytime we see anybody else getting some help, we need to be, we need to be suspicious of that and hostile to that. And I hope, I should say, that if we pass the job guarantee, the experience of an economy that works for everybody and where everybody is made better off year after year would become much more universal. And that itself would affect cultural perception. Like maybe you have a situation where people say, well, the job guarantee is available for everybody. This person's still not working. Well, maybe it's because they're old or they're disabled or like they're in this social circumstance that really prevents them. And so my hope, I guess, is that this would actually in some ways help the politics of providing a more generous social safety net. Like I don't know the future, and I am not like a trained sociologist, so this is spitballing, but I guess I would say that is my hope.
What makes this better than the UBI, which is the Universal Basic Income, where basically the government, the idea behind the UBI, I think as our audience is familiar with, is that the government would basically provide everybody with a stipend as a baseline, and so that people would have money. And how is it better? Does it complement it? What's its relationship to it?
So there's this thing that's developed where like fans of the job guarantee and fans of the UBI tend to view each other sometimes as rivals, which like I am not into that. I am not a fan. I like the UBI. I do think overall the job guarantee is maybe is like the project we should prioritize. And I would say that for a few different reasons. First off, just in terms of practical politics, the price tag for like a UBI that would really like a UBI that would be really worth its salt would be enormous, like at least twice, probably maybe three times the tag of the job guarantee at its largest. I also think there is like there's the question of social norms, just like the fact that we view work as important as like a social, a kind of good for like the social fabric and for individuals in and of themselves. And I know that like some UBI advocates like actually want to break apart the idea of receiving income for work. And I am not unsympathetic to that cause, but I think it's like, there's a practical political aspect that needs to be dealt with. The other thing I think I would say is that even if you institute a UBI, I think it would have several good effects on the labor market in that it gives workers an exit. So they also get more bargaining power for over wages and benefits and that sort of thing. The same bargaining power the job guarantee would give workers, they would also get with the UBI somewhat. So I think it would definitely help. But one thing that I think is worth pointing out is that like, even with the UBI, you still have to deal with the tax system and particularly the Federal Reserve and its tendency to like get freaked out about inflation, jack up interest rates, and hold down economic growth. So you could, the one thing that I think is particularly great about the job guarantee is it really works towards making labor markets permanently tight. Like that is just intrinsic to what it does. And the UBI could do that, but how taxes and how interest rates would interact with the UBI would have serious consequences. So I think the job guarantee, in terms of like the goal of permanently tightening labor markets, is more self-contained.
Yeah, expand on that, the relationship between the Fed and the labor markets. And I mean, I think you're touching on that as you talk about why a job guarantee is a little more effective in sort of insulating workers from the Fed's confusion about their mandate. I mean, I guess I'm editorializing there, but talk about that. Like, what normally happens when? Because in this instance of the job guarantee, right? The full employment, which we perceive as full employment, would drop substantially. To, you know, 2% unemployment or something like that. I'm just throwing that out there. And the fact that there's a guarantee of employment sort of insulates workers from the Fed freaking out about that.
Right. So to just kind of lay the groundwork of what the Federal Reserve does, right? Like, if they're worried about inflation taking off, they raise interest rates to cool off inflation. If they're worried that there's, like, the economy isn't generating enough jobs, they lower interest rates to encourage job growth. One thing I think to keep in mind here is that when you raise interest rates, the way that fights inflation as a practical matter is it throws people out of work. It forces businesses to either contract or not expand as much as they would otherwise. So people who are unemployed and would like to work cannot find work. I mean, that is, and these are usually, I should also add, the most underprivileged people in the workforce, people who are disabled, who are not white, who are, you know, have already suffered long spells of unemployment, who have been incarcerated in the past. These are all the people hit hardest by that particular methodology of controlling inflation. And like that, I mean, and that is the practical mechanism, is the idea behind Fed policy is inflation is set off by an arms race between private employers when there's no new people to pull into the labor market. They just have to pull workers from each other, and that requires like perpetual wage hikes that then spiral into inflation growth. And so the idea of a job guarantee is that like if that arms race between employers gets out of hand, it can cool it off. But it doesn't cool it off by throwing people into unemployment. It cools them off by just putting them on the job guarantee. And then they can move back into the private market as soon as like the wage price spiral cools off and inflation is no longer a big deal. So the most ambitious economists promoting the job guarantee actually suggest that we could fundamentally change the Federal Reserve's mandate to like control inflation or promote employment by jacking interest rates up and down. Other economists who are also sympathetic to the job guarantee are a lot more skeptical of that and think maybe the Fed would like still basically be the same as it is now. But that is definitely an aspect of this to keep in mind.
All right. Lastly, are there any politicians who have adopted this? I mean, are there any national politician, anybody in Congress, anybody in the Senate? Is there any receptivity to it?
I do not know of any national politicians who have advocated for this. I do know there are representatives, particularly in the House, John Conyers comes to mind, who have been fans of full employment for a long time. And I think this would be the kind of policy that they would be interested in. I mean, the Congressional Black Caucus has been very big on full employment for a long time. That is a goal that like the progressive left of the House has always been thinking about. And I don't know how far the job guarantee idea itself has percolated in those circles, but I think it clearly fits in with that like overall philosophy.
In the event that modern monetary theory does not catch up to the popularity of this proposal, has anybody like sort of mapped out what the funding, where funding would come from? Would it be a payroll tax? Where would it come from?
That is a good question. And I do not, I cannot give you an answer right off the top of my head. I do not know of anyone who has mapped out payments. Like you said, like a big fans of the job guarantee are, the modern monetary theory people. And they really emphasize that, like, we have vastly more room
right.
deficit spend than we think we do. And they basically say, like, you know, precisely because the upper limits on our deficit spending is the risk of inflation, and because the job guarantee, like theoretically, could control inflation largely itself, they basically say, like, I mean, they basically say it, the job guarantee should be all or mostly deficit financed. And again, I want to say that, like, that is an ambitious proposal that even a lot of left wing economists who favor the job guarantee would not be on board with. In terms of like funding mechanisms, to be honest, I haven't really seen that many proposals for that. Like, my personal bias would be, like, you know, fund it with income tax hikes on the well-off. But,
right. I mean, financial, like, you know, transaction tax would be nice, too.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, Jeff, it's really it's a fascinating idea, and I'm glad to see it getting I'm glad to see somebody writing it up, and hopefully we'll hear more of it. Jeff Spross. The piece is You're Hired. We will link to it at majority.fm.
Okay, thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I like it. I'm down with that. Big time. Big time.
You're big time down with that.
I'm big time down with that. Legit, as Milo is now saying.
Can you just explain modern money monetary theory? What's the...
Well, I'm actually thinking we need to have Stephanie Kelton on. And somebody's been asking me, a couple of people on Twitter, and we haven't had her on in a while. The idea is that our perception of the potential dangers of spending, of deficit financing things, are stuck in an era when our money supply was tied to a tangible resource, i.e. gold. So now that because we are a sovereign nation, because we have control of our own money supply, and also because of, you know, I think the strength of the dollar, that we cannot have inflation as a function of monetary policy, as opposed to inflation that could come from a shortage of whatever, as a function of supply, of increased demand versus supply. The idea is that it used to be if you put too much money in the economy, it's going to get overheated, and it could run away, as opposed to in the event that it got overheated, you just take the money out of circulation. But you know what? We should have Stephanie Kelton come back on. Maybe she could. This would be a good sort of peg,
yeah,
for her to explain how. But it's largely, not largely, and not exclusively, but the biggest proponents of monetary theory seem to come out of, I think it's the University of Kansas. Like Bill Black gets out of there. Also Walter Moser, I think it is. But we'll have her back on. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. A reminder, this program exists more and more between the YouTube stuff and the this and the that as a function of your membership. If you have the financial means to become a member, please do so at jointhemajorityreport.com. If you don't, but you still want the bonus material that we give our members, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will work out a deal with you. We're about to have like our first extra bonus, special surprise soon. And that is Film Guy Matthew is going to come in next Friday. And he's going to screen for us the documentary he made. At the, he didn't want to just send a link. He wanted to screen it in front of us.
I'm stuck at a Polish bridge somewhere.
It's possible we may have to give him an award or something. I think it's part of it is he just wants to be here and feel the love of his,
should bust out a red carpet tour for him.
Maybe like we could do a whole thing. Like there's a red carpet. We take some paparazzi shots. Yeah.
Give him a goblet.
Well, you know what he's going to do with the goblet, right?
Sell it on eBay.
Sell it on eBay.
That's what I'm looking out for him.
And sell it on eBay.
Is Mary coming?
I don't know. I have not dug into the details.
I bet she is. Come on, Sam.
Get on it, man.
They're probably both going to be dressed to the nines.
You got a plan.
And
yeah, now I know.
They'll come in.
We should all be in tuxes.
Also, folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, yes, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap through Amazon or jet.com, head over to majorityreportkickback.com, buy it through our links, we get a kickback. I'm not supposed to say what you do with those links in terms of putting them somewhere on your browser or anything like that, so I won't. Not going to say it. I don't need to.
But if you figure out a way to make them easily accessible.
There's plenty of ways. People do it all the time.
Well, people do things. They know things. Maybe they do them. Maybe they don't. I don't fucking know. It's your fucking computer.
646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM us. We'll be right back after this.